Hello, fellow Kentuckians and other friends, and welcome to a new edition of my Old Kentucky Podcast. My name is Robert Connie, and joining me, as always, is Jasmine Smith. Jasmine, how are you today?
I'm doing well, Robert. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Today on the show, we have Representative Cluster Howard as our guest. He is a representative in the 91st District. I think on our election preview show, I called this district the gateway to Appalachia. It goes from Madison County, just south of Richmond, all the way down into Estill County, Lee County, Owsley County, Breathitt County, that area. If you've ever been to the Red River Gorge, you've driven through part of this district. He had a lot of good things to say. I really enjoyed him. And he's got an all-time name, don't you think? Cluster Howard.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Yeah, and you know, we heard from some listeners that we don't talk to enough people from the mountains. So, you know.
They were right. We haven't.
Yeah, and we think we're going to get some more folks from out in the state on the show soon, too. So before we speak with him, we have plenty of news to get to. I'm going to talk to us a little bit about the budget cuts that are happening in Louisville. Jasmine's going to tell us about a new lawsuit featuring Andy Beshear and Matt Bevin, part, you know what, 80 at this point.
Yeah.
And then finally, we have some fundraising news to tell you about before we get to some quick hits. The quick hits are going to be pretty exciting because there's been a lot of news that happened like very recently that we didn't get to write notes on. So there you go. But without any further ado, let's talk about Louisville's budget. Okay, Jasmine, last Thursday, Louisville Mayor Greg Fisher released his proposals for the city's budget, which is a big hole due to changes in how the state calculates pension liabilities. We've talked about this pretty much at length over the past several shows. Headlining the cuts that Mayor Fisher proposed were eliminations of one firehouse, one ambulance, two libraries, which are Middletown and Fern Creek, your library, RIP, four pools, and a police recruiting class. In addition, 312 city jobs would be going away, 224 through attrition, which means they're vacant now and just wouldn't be filled, and 88 people would get layoffs. And additionally, 17 school resource officers would no longer be supported by the city itself. Additionally, the city is cutting funding for the Living Room, which is a diversion program from Centerstone that diverts people with mental illness who are in crisis from jail and the ER, and also ends ShotSpotter, which is a tool for identifying gunshots that went in place in West Louisville. So the mayor said that the city spends $500 on each unique person that the Living Room sees and $45 per swim in a city pool.
So these were the two things that I feel like are so important. Having a pool when kids are out of school for the summer, kids that don't really may not get to go anywhere, I feel like that's a huge loss. And the Living Room is also such a good resource. If you work in, you know, mental health treatment or in criminal justice, you know that it's really hard to find beds and treatment places for people. And this was just a really good resource. So that's a huge loss as well.
Yeah. And you hear those direct costs and you see like $45 per swim. That's insane. And you think about how many people go to the pool and you add that up and you're like, that's a lot. But then when you start thinking about like, okay, well, what are you diverting by having a kid go to the pool? And like, are they staying out of trouble? If they get into trouble, how much is it going to cost the city in terms of paying a public defender, housing them in jail, et cetera, et cetera. And those costs can really add up. So diverting people away from those situations by getting them into the pool and paying $45 seems like more of a deal at that point. And the same deal for the living room.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, $500 on each person. Yeah, that seems like a lot. But, you know, what's a bed per night at the jail cost? What is, you know, having them, you know, a policeman arrest that person or try to wrangle that person and then have a public defender come in and deal with them and then all that. $500 at that point may not seem like so much. So yeah, I kind of get it when you have to make costs. And I mean, the mayor would probably agree that he thinks that these things are probably worth it in the long run. But, you know, we have to find $35 million to cut. And there you go. So Jasmine, this was a significant departure from what the mayor suggested as potential cuts when this crisis began. So the Louisville Youth Detention Center, community ministries, fire and police, and the health department ended up in better shape than the mayor's original document, which had $45 million in cuts. However, the library did significantly worse.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Jasmine, that's
went from one to two.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's your library that they're losing, the Middletown Library, right?
It is, but I'm getting a new one.
Yeah.
The Northeast one hasn't opened yet,
yeah.
And that's going to be my new library.
I mean, I'm really sad about the Middletown Library, Jasmine. Honestly, that is where I learned to read. So, you know.
Yeah.
And that's a really cool old building, and it's really, I mean, I think it's cool. Probably if you walked in there and you had never seen it before, you'd be like, this is
you
weird.
You might not think it's cool
yeah.
if...
It's like super special to me though because it was like my library
yeah.
growing up. So
mm-hmm.
like it just
I get that
place looks and feels like a library to me, and now it's going away, which is super sad. Okay, so the total cuts in the budget that the mayor proposed only amount to $25.5 million. And previously, the mayor had said that $35 million in cuts would be necessary. According to a spokesman at the mayor's office, there were changes to the city's revenue, which meant that fewer cuts would be necessary. But that's just what the mayor's office said. In addition, the mayor is assuming $1.2 million in new property tax revenue, which seems like it's risky to assume that the city will raise taxes, given that they just like basically thumbed their nose at a tax increase when it was super necessary already.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and then additionally, there was some skepticism in the media about the $35 million not being based on like anything real. You know, we knew these additional pension liabilities were coming towards us, but when asked for justification about $35 million, the city was a little bit less forthcoming. But it does kind of seem like the skepticism about how high that number is does seem to have been the case. And you know, I don't know where the city came up with $9.5 million or even like, you know, $8 million in new revenue from like just changes, minor changes that happen in the estimate. So
right.
It's kind of weird. Okay, the GOP and the Democrats who voted against the tax increase, they cited the reduced amount that needed to be cut as vindication of their votes, which I think is totally ridiculous because we still have to make like $25.5 million in cuts just because you're like, hey, we don't have to cut $35 million. We were right to not increase revenue is just frankly insane to me. But
yeah. You know.
Okay, so Jasmine, the next step in this process is that the Metro Council is going to review the mayor's budget to make changes. Several council members have expressed concern about cuts to the police budget, but that's like where most of the cuts come from. I say most, that doesn't mean more than 50%. I just mean it's the plurality. It's where of all the things that were cut, that was the largest piece of the pie. So exempting the police department from cuts would mean we'd have to make some significant cuts in other places.
Yeah.
Yeah. Removing the cuts to the police budget would mean we'd have to make $6 million is a specific figure. We'd have to cut $6 million from other places, which, you know, I don't know what that's going to look like. We will see what happens, but this is a bad story. And, you know, I think, I don't know, are you feeling better or worse or about the same?
Probably about the same, because I think some things I'm okay with. I'm okay with the city getting rid of 17 school resource officers. I think JCPS can take that on themselves. So I'm okay with some of these things, but some of them are big losses, I think.
Yeah, the school resource officers thing is kind of interesting to me because, you know, they're probably still going to be there, but now JCPS is going to have to find a way to pay for them and they have their own revenue sources. So it kind of felt like the city was saying, you know, we're not able to raise revenue. Maybe JCPS will have better luck. So,
I don't know. I think no matter what happens, there are going to be bad cuts all around. So
no,
it's
certainly
pretty much the same for me.
Yeah. All right, Jasmine, tell us about Andy Beshear in the Labor Cabinet.
Okay, so Bevin's Labor Cabinet has issued subpoenas for an investigation into the teacher sick outs, mm-hmm. basically. So now Andy Beshear has filed a lawsuit to block the subpoenas, and he's asking for an injunction before the schools have to actually send in these records. JCTA is also part of the lawsuit, so it's Beshear and JCTA versus the Labor Cabinet. Before filing the complaint, he sent a letter stating that issuing the subpoenas exceeds the Labor Cabinet's authority and that they're violating teachers' First Amendment rights. Mm-hmm. So the Labor Cabinet Secretary David Dickerson says that they're allowed to investigate whether employees broke a law that would prohibit public employees from striking. Mm-hmm. So the Labor Cabinet can actually fine employees up to $1,000 for that. So this law actually comes from the right to work bill that was passed
really?
In 2017. Mm-hmm.
Wow. So the right to work bill actually included prohibitions on teachers striking?
On striking and work stoppage is what it prohibits. So I was going to go through basically each argument and the complaint because Beshear and JCTA lays out several arguments as to why the Labor Cabinet can't do this.
Okay.
So first we have a violation of Section 2 of the Kentucky Constitution.
All right.
And so Section 2 states that absolute and arbitrary power over the lives, liberty, and property of free men exists nowhere in a republic, not even in the largest majority.
Wow.
So they are saying that issuing these subpoenas was an exercise of arbitrary power.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first argument. The second one is that they violated Sections 1 and 8 of the Kentucky Constitution. And this is basically our version of the U.S. Constitution's First Amendment right. So okay. This includes the right to freely communicate thoughts and opinions, the right of assembling together in a peaceable manner for the common good, things like that. Mm-hmm. And section 8 says every person may freely and fully speak, write, and print on any subject, being responsible for the abuse of that liberty. Mm-hmm. This is basically, you know, the equivalent of a First Amendment argument that the Labor Cabinet's action have had a chilling effect on these rights and infringed on them.
Right.
They're also arguing, number 3, is that the Labor Secretary exceeded his statutory authority. So the Labor Secretary has statutory rights to prosecute violations of state law, and that gives him subpoena power to do that as well. And the Labor Secretary has said that they're specifically investigating violations of KRS 336.130. Mm-hmm. That's the no strike or work stoppage law.
And that's part of the, is that part of the right to work law?
Yes, it is. The Labor Secretary's saying, I have these statutory rights to prosecute violations. We think there's a violation, so that's why we're investigating and issuing subpoenas, and I have subpoena power. Mm-hmm. But the plaintiffs are arguing that what the teachers did was not striking or work stoppage under the statute, but rather constitutionally protected speech, so the Labor Secretary did not have subpoena power over what they were doing.
Right. Yeah, that's kind of interesting. I guess that will kind of be up to the court to decide, because it's like a strike makes sense because you're, you know, outside of your workplace and there's like a picket line and you're holding signs about specifically a grievance against the place where you're working. And this is more of like people protesting the passage of specific bills. But what constitutes a strike or work stoppage, it seems like it will end up being a question for the court.
Right. So that's kind of next.
Oh, okay.
So the next argument is that KRS 336.130, the striking and work stoppage law, is vague and overbroad. So the plaintiffs are arguing that the statute is unconstitutionally vague and overbroad because strike and work stoppage are not defined in the statute.
There you go. There you go.
There you go. So unconstitutionally vague and overbroad, those are two different things. So a statute is unconstitutionally vague if it doesn't put someone on notice or its enforcement would be arbitrary. Mm-hmm. So if you don't know who the law is protecting, what it's doing, how you enforce it, it's too vague.
Mm-hmm. All right.
A statute is overbroad if in an effort to control impermissible conduct, you also prohibit permissible things.
Interesting.
So in an effort to curb one thing, you're also prohibiting, you know, First Amendment speech.
That's something that's specifically allowed.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So those are two different things. The plaintiffs are arguing that it's both, that it's unconstitutionally vague and it's unconstitutionally overbroad.
Yeah.
They're also arguing that that the Labor Cabinet has violated KRS 336.130 subsection 2. So this is the strike and work stoppage law, but there's a second section that says neither employees or their agents shall engage or be permitted to engage in unfair or illegal acts or practices or resort in violence, intimidation, threats, or coercion. So the Labor Cabinet is alleging violations of subsection 1 of the statute that says that people can't strike, right?
Uh-huh, right.
Bashir and JCTA are saying, well, you actually violated subsection 2 that says you can't resort to violence, intimidation, threats, coercion.
Yeah.
Or engage in illegal acts. So
right.
The plaintiffs are saying that the Bevin administration's actions towards teachers in all of this is a violation of this very same statute. And they're arguing that it's like a cumulative thing, that the request of the information, Matt Bevin's public comments, the subpoenas, that all of these things together were coercive, unfair, and illegal.
Yeah.
So I thought that was the most interesting argument to me.
Yeah, that's kind of funny that they were like, hey, this one part you thought that we were doing wrong, but it actually turns out that you're wrong on this other part of this exact same law.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
So then there's also an argument that they violated section 51 of the Kentucky Constitution. So this section says that no law enacted by the General Assembly shall relate to more than one subject, and that shall be expressed in the title.
Mm-hmm.
So this is actually an argument that this whole statute is unconstitutional, because the plaintiffs are saying that KRS 336.130 is unconstitutional because it's a right to work bill, not a strike and work stoppage bill, and they didn't put that in the title. Right. They called it a right to work bill.
So let me ask you this. It seems like that they have all these specific arguments. You know, it's vague and overbroad. You know, they're actually violating subsection 2. This third one just seems like if you want to, Supreme Court of Kentucky, you can go ahead and rule the entire right to work law unconstitutional. Like, I'm going to, like, allow
you... Well, not the whole law, but this strike and work stoppage part of it.
Okay, okay. All right, yeah.
So, and then, you know, finally, they're asking for injunctive relief, which means they're asking the judge to stop the labor secretary from enforcing these subpoenas. Mm-hmm. And these, you know, all of the arguments that we went through are the reasons why the judge should do that. Guess what? This case has been assigned to Judge Philip Shepherd. It's going to be heard on May 6th, which is just 4 days before the teachers are required to comply with the subpoenas.
Right, which is May 10th.
Yep.
All right, Jasmine, let me ask you this, okay? One thing that I think is funny, at least. So the vague and overbroad thing. This is the right to work law. When we passed the right to work law, it was like one of the first things that the Republican legislature passed after they came into power. And they had been trying to pass this bill for like a decade or more while they were in the minority. They were like, if we come into power, we're going to pass this right to work law. And Jasmine, you would think, or at least I would think, that if you have worked for years and years and years on the same piece of legislation, you would make sure...
You'd have like really good definitions in there,
right? You would have like ironclad definitions about what these things are. And you'd have thought through like, what happens if this actually gets passed? How are we going to defend it in court? It's just funny to me that like they didn't define these things. I mean, in reading legislation, like this is something that's really important in a lot of bills. You'll always see like the first things like defines what this and what this is. And I know that like, Josie Raymond had her universal pre-K law. And there's like a whole section about what constitutes preschool, you know, all this kind of stuff. And it's just kind of funny that like they didn't define these things in their law. All right, Jasmine, the last thing we want to talk about before quick hits is the 30-day prior fundraising reports are out for statewide candidates. Jasmine, I was on TV talking about this. It was kind of funny. I was on the Spectrum Pure Politics show. And I got to say, video is awful. and you know, I'm sure that our listeners may not fully know this, but you know, we edit the show pretty heavily, and when you're dealing with video, you can't edit out all the ums and ahs and stuff, and I felt like I sounded like an idiot. So now everybody who both watches Pure Politics and listens to the show now know how I actually sound, which is like an idiot most of the time.
I can't confirm because I haven't watched it yet, but I'm sure you sounded great.
Yeah, well, we'll see. My mom liked it, which, you know, my mom and my wife both liked it, which I don't think counts for anything. Okay, Jasmine, on Saturday, we got to look at the fundraising for all the major gubernatorial candidates across the state. And so here are the headline numbers. Among Democrats, Adam Edelin raised the most, $2.35 million. Andy Beshear was in second with $1.87 million. And Rocky Adkins raised $1.50 million. On the GOP side, Matt Bevin raised $814,000, and Robert Goforth raised $766,000. Now, those are the headline numbers, but it becomes a lot more complicated when we take into account the impact of loans. Loans often come from the candidates themselves. If you're going to give yourself, if you're going to self-fund, loans are the ways that in which you do that. Edelin led the way by far. He had $1.5 million in loans.
I don't think this is surprising.
Yeah,
right?
Not at all. Not at all. And that all came from his running mate, Gil Holland, who is part of the Brown family.
Yes.
Yes, who are very well off politically connected folks in Louisville. Robert Goforth had the second most loans. He had $750,000 in loans that he gave to himself. That's a lot.
Which is most of his total.
Almost all of it. Yeah, almost all of it. And Jeff Young loaned himself $54,000. We didn't even talk about him at the top, but that's basically all of his money. I called him perennial quixotic candidate Jeff Young. And I think the last run-in we had with him was at the New Kentucky Project when he held up a sign calling Amy McGrath a war criminal. So, and Andy Beshear had $20,000 in loans, but those came all the way back at the very beginning of his campaign. So, Jasmine, in terms of geography, most of the money is coming from central Kentucky. 58% of all giving to the candidates came from central Kentucky. However, different candidates are dependent on different regions. Edelin, Beshear, and Bevin received a majority of their money from central Kentucky, but Rocky Adkins actually raised more than half of his money from eastern Kentucky.
Right. That definitely makes sense.
Right. All of this is making sense. And another thing that makes sense is that, unsurprisingly, Western Kentucky and Northern Kentucky gave the least among Kentucky regions. Western Kentucky accounted for 14% of contributions, which is just really little. And Northern Kentucky only accounted for 3% of total giving, which is very small. None of the candidates running have much of a base of support in these areas.
Yeah, that's true.
And it's just really surprising. I mean, Northern Kentucky, there's a lot of people that live up there. That's an area where Republicans should really be able to finance from. And also, there's a lot of money up there. But, you know, they're not depending on Northern Kentucky for money. Most of it is coming from Central Kentucky. In urban areas, some zip codes really stuck out. 40207, home of Mockingbird Valley and Indian Hills in Louisville, if you're familiar with those neighborhoods where very wealthy people live, they had $210,110 in contributions from that one zip code. 40502, which is home of Chevy Chase and the Idle Hour Country Club in Lexington, which are very fancy places, that zip code had $184,954. The biggest amount attributed to any county outside of Jefferson Fayette was $150,000. So those two zip codes were more than any other county that was not, Jefferson or Fayette.
And those are two pretty well-off zip codes.
Those are very well-off zip codes. And they're also, like, not that big. They're kind of small zip codes. Geographically speaking, there's a lot of people that live there. But, there's a lot of money coming from those places. So, Jasmine, my takeaway from this is that our democracy is heavily dependent on rich people to do messaging. So that obviously is going to have some downstream effects on how people get elected and what kinds of people get elected. So the disbursement reports also came out, and I had a little bit of a trouble getting them to work. I can't really start to tell you too much about the disbursements reports. However, Jasmine, I would say if you can handle the hours, I encourage you to find work as a campaign manager. It's pretty lucrative, especially compared to, like, you know, what we do. So from a high-level perspective, Edelin has the least cash on hand of any campaign. So comparing disbursements to contributions, he's already spent $1.8 million of the $2.35 million that he's raised, mostly on media. He's only left with $533,000. But Jasmine, I bet he can get more money if he needs it.
I think so, too.
Yeah. So there you go. That's the information we have about fundraising. You should also check out my video on Spectrum. Annie Anderson of Pure Politics interviewed me. It was real fun. I got to be on TV. I wore my tie. I asked my wife to pick out my outfit. So there you go. I'm actually talking about Democrats. I talked about Democrats yesterday. Yesterday would be Tuesday of this week. And I think the Republican part will come out tonight. So there you go. If you have Spectrum, you should watch that. Okay, Jasmine, lastly, let's talk about some quick hits. Quick hits today are pretty exciting because it's some major stuff that we just didn't have time to get to. According to a Courier Journal report, Senator Morgan McGarvey and Damon Thayer both say that Matt Bevin might call a special session on Monday. If you're counting, that's 2 days after the Kentucky Derby. Joe Sonka of Insider Louisville actually got the text of the bill. It runs to 60 pages. I haven't reviewed most of it because it's not the technical, or it's not the summary, it's the full bill. That's a lot to parse through. And it's a long bill. And the Derby is Saturday, so I would suspect that lawmakers' minds are elsewhere. So I don't know what's going to happen on Monday.
Matt Bevin's timing, always impeccable.
Right. Yeah. You know, I don't know what's, I mean, I don't know if he just expects these people to come in and be like, yep, vote for it. Especially after everything that's happened with the last special session and the fact that he vetoed their bill. Okay, Jasmine, the Kentucky health case is headed to an appeal, and oral arguments will be heard by October. It's headed to the D.C. Court of Appeals. We had to re-record this because I blew it. It's not in Kentucky. The jurisdiction's in D.C.
D.C. Circuit.
So the D.C. Circuit is going to hear the appeal. The program itself, though, is not slated to start before April, and the oral arguments are not supposed to be heard until October. So regardless of what the appeals court says, this case will be moot if in January we are not inaugurating Matt Bevin as the governor of Kentucky, because if it's a Democrat, they're probably going to be like, well, we're just going to withdraw this waiver altogether. Jasmine, the lawsuit filed by the ACLU against the Bevin administration regarding blocks on social media is moving forward. And just today, which is the 1st of May, All of the documentation of the Bevin administration's blocks has been made public.
Yeah, this was a pretty interesting day on Twitter.
Yeah, it made it super fun. We don't have much info, like specifically, I don't know. We're just getting the court filings from journalists on Twitter mostly. But, you know, if you are blocked by the governor, you may be able to find out why. I'm not blocked by the governor, are you?
No, I'm not.
Okay, you know, I don't know what we're doing wrong here, but yeah. Don't block us. Okay. And lastly, Stephanie Horn, a candidate for lieutenant governor, who Rocky Adkins' running mate, she was in a car accident yesterday on April the 30th. She had to go to the ER, but appears able to return to campaigning this week. So get well soon, Stephanie Horn.
Yeah, we're glad she's okay.
Yeah, me too. All right. That's it for this part. Let's listen to our interview with Representative Cluster Howard. Cluster Howard is a member of the Kentucky House of Representatives from District 91, which consists of Estill, Lee, Owsley, Breathitt, and part of Madison County. The district mostly follows Kentucky 52 as the state transitions from the Bluegrass region to Appalachia. Representative Howard won his election this fall by a total of 7 votes. His election was the third between him and Republican Toby Harold. Representative Howard has won twice, and Mr. Harold has won once. Representative Howard is also a professor of health at Hazard Community and Technical College. Cluster Howard, welcome to Mile Kentucky Podcast.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
All right. So a few weeks ago, we talked to Representative Sherrilyn Stevenson, who won her election by 48 votes, and told us that election night nearly gave her a heart attack. So 48 votes is basically a landslide compared to your election. But maybe you're a little more used to the close elections. How did election night go for you?
Oh, well, thanks for that question. Representative Stevenson's a fine lady and did a good job as a new representative. But really, the election night was a little bit confusing because initially they had me winning by 1,200 or 1,400 votes. And, of course, I knew that wasn't correct because we had people on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And then late in the night, KEA went ahead and called the race for Representative Harold. But then later, they had not counted some absentee votes in one of the counties, and that's how I ended up winning by 7 votes. But, you know, to be honest with you, at one point I gave up, and my wife actually was out of town, and she called me and said, well, no, Cluster, you've won the election. I said, no, I've lost. But that's kind of how it went.
Yeah, so that was a roller coaster then.
It sounds like it.
Right.
So you've run for this seat 3 times now, and each election's been a really tough race. And additionally, you're running to be part of basically a super minority of Democrats. So what is it about the legislature that keeps you running in these tough elections?
Well, you know, it is very difficult. Campaigning is difficult. Fundraising is difficult. And I'm in basically a Republican district.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I felt like that whether you're in the minority or majority, that the people that you represent deserve effective representation and people that will work on their behalf. And I feel like that I do that. You know, I show up to all the meetings in Frankfort. I entertain people there that want to come and learn about the legislature. In addition, I try to help Barry.
Well, those are good reasons to run for sure. And you know, that is true. Everybody does deserve representation like that. Most of the representatives we've spoken to this year from pretty compact urban districts, you know, and those can be a little divided, but, you know, your district covers several whole counties, and each of those counties has their own kind of distinct identity. Your district has really distinct dividing lines. You know, Breathitt County is very Democratic, especially in races like yours for the state legislature. And you know, Estill, Owsley, and Lee counties are more Republican, with Estill being very Republican. When you're campaigning, you know, how do you approach that? How do you approach going to all these different places and talking to people? Do you tailor your message differently based on who you're talking to or where you are?
My philosophy is to get out among the people. I have a lot of town forums where I actually have people come in to ask me questions, and I continue to do that throughout my tenure. And what I try to preach, and my motto was people over politics, person over party. You've got to look at the person who you think can represent you. I've got to go to each one of these, as you call them, distinct areas, and get my message out, but more importantly, hear their message, hear their concern. I think in politics, we've gotten to the point, we've gotten so partisan that the message of the people we represent sometimes is not heard, and it's just the political message of a party, and particularly we've nationalized these small regional races, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me.
Right. That's certainly true, that we've nationalized mostly everything in this country, which certainly doesn't make too much sense to me either. You know, beyond campaigning, though, like you mentioned, you have to be a representative to these people, and you've mentioned that as something that you think is important. And it does seem like that different parts of this district certainly have different priorities and things that they want emphasized or things that they care about. So how do you go about being a representative for such a, you know, politically diverse district?
Well, I think that they are very diverse, and this is probably one of the most impoverished districts, not only in Kentucky, but in the nation. So that makes it even more important that you try to do things that can help people improve their lives. And what I try to do is, they are very diverse, but they're alike in many ways. Mm-hmm. One of the ways is that they all desire more economic development. They're also very connected and close to their community. So I try to approach it like that rather than saying Alger County's this way and Waco's this way. I try to incorporate what I feel like are these similar things and work from that standpoint.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do remember, I don't know if this is still the case, but Owsley County was the poorest county in the entire country at one point when I was in school. You know, and it is a pretty impoverished place. But, you know, we've talked a little bit about how these places are different politically, but it is the case that they're getting less like that. Your election victory in 2018 was much less dependent on Breathitt County than your victory in 2014. In 2014, Breathitt County definitely came out for you, but some of the other counties like Lee County and Owsley County were much more Republican. And then in 2018, when you won, you didn't have as much vote from Breathitt, but Lee came in. You know, you had a lot more of the vote. You earned 43% of the vote versus 34% in 2014, and you got 47, almost a majority in Owsley County versus 40% in 2014. So, you know, was there anything that had to do with your campaign, or what insights do you have into, you know, how things are changing out there in your part of the state?
I think that even though we are in a very partisan environment, I do think people are starting to ascertain that if you are a person that's approachable, a person who does put people over politics, that they will consider you. And I think that's what helped me in those two particular counties. You know, my opponent had a record. We told, you know, people what his record was. We had debates in Estill County. And all I said was, you know, I believe that both people running had the same goals, which was to improve the area. But sometimes you need to listen and see which person you think can better obtain that goal. And that's what we tried to say. We said, you know, I've got experience. I've worked in education all these years. I believe that the pathway I'm giving to you can be more effective, but you have to decide that. And I think that worked well for us.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about your legislative session. So during the session, you were a co-sponsor on 18 bills, and it was a really bipartisan affair. You co-sponsored 9 Republican bills and 9 Democratic bills. So tell us a little bit about how you decide when to add your name as a co-sponsor to a bill.
Well, you know, I'm going to be completely honest with you. I didn't this time primary sponsor any bills, because to be quite frank with you, they're not going to get heard. The majority, in this case, a supermajority, they're going to push the legislation. And there's a lot of representatives who go in and they sponsor bills, but they're not going to be heard. What I try to do is look at bills that I feel like have a chance of getting heard, whether they be Democratic or Republican. And you know, some of the times I may co-sponsor a bill that I know won't be heard, but it might be making a statement like something to do with the pensions or one of those big issues.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I try to do. And, you know, sponsoring bills is one part of the legislature, but many people don't understand there's so many other things you can do to assist people. You can point them in the right direction. You can, because a lot of people don't understand government or the services that we have. You can be accessible. You know, I print my phone number. People call me all hours of the night. I always accept their calls because, you know, that is, I'm very representative, and if they can't, you know, get to me for some help, you know, what's the alternative?
Mm-hmm. So you were the lone Democratic sponsor on two bills that were sponsored by Representative Mark Hart. One dealt with water fluoridation and the other dealt with appointments on school boards. So tell us specifically why you decided to go it alone across the aisle on these two particular bills and a little bit about the bipartisan nature of your relationship with Representative Hart.
To be honest with you, Mark, Representative Hart sits near me in the legislature, so I had personal contact with him.
That makes sense.
Got some information about that. Also, he's a retired firefighter, and I've always been a supporter of first responders.
Sure.
So he liked that. And then we knew people, one of the individuals that he retired with from the fire department is from Budget County. So we most knew him. So that personal contact made it easy to have a bipartisan approach to things. And, you know, that's what we need more of, not only in Frankfort, but across the country. You know, there's good Republicans, there's good Democrats, there's good independents, and we need to do more of this. And if you personally get involved with people, then a lot of times you can work with them a lot better.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's hope he returns the favor when Democrats are back in charge.
Well, we hope so.
So along with many other Democrats from some of the more rural districts, you did vote with Republicans on several of the abortion, guns, and religion bills that came before the legislature this year. So while you did vote for these bills, do you feel like it was a good use of the legislature's time to take up these types of bills?
Well, now I think that's a very fair point you made there. One could argue that passing bills, you know, will be shut down is bad policy. But like I told you before, the Republican supermajority sets policy. And it's a fair point, the one you're making. If you're stating policy or voting on bills that are going to be struck down, is that a good use of legislative time? What I did was survey the people that I represent, and overwhelmingly, they were for these particular bills. And regardless of my particular position, I'm a representative of the people that I do represent. It's not my house, it's their house. I'm just someone that's going to be there for a short period of time. So when I looked at 200 emails and 187 are for a particular bill, 10's against it, then or the phone calls I take into consideration. And that's the reason that I voted that way on a lot of the particular bills. And I understand you take like Senate Bill 150, which was a concealed carry bill.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're living in Louisville, that's a lot different than living in Owsley County. I mean, you might be carrying a gun in Owsley County, and you may live a half a mile from your neighbor. In Louisville, you know, there's hundreds of people within close proximity. And remember, in urban districts, a lot of those people are voting their constituents just as well as people in rural districts. And one thing that did bother me is when people from urban areas, I didn't appreciate the criticism I got sometimes from my own party because, you know, they're voting their constituents. No difference in what I'm doing.
Yeah, that's an interesting perspective on that, and I do appreciate that. You know, everybody has a different constituency, and I do understand that. You know, it certainly is the case that most Democrats from rural districts do face a concentrated attack on these issues when it comes to election season, which isn't necessarily felt as strongly in the urban districts. And I know that's something you faced in the past, so that's not too surprising. And like you said, it's not like these weren't going to pass anyway. So that's one
that's
thing.
That's true. But I think your point's a good point. Is it good use of time? Is it good policy and good use of state resources to sponsor bills, whatever they are, that you know are going to be struck down as illegal? You know, I don't set the policy, but the supermajority does. I think I understand why they do it, but your point, you could argue that that's not good use of state time and state resources.
Yeah.
Maybe if they took some time away from those and spent some more time on that quasi's bill, you guys wouldn't have to be going back into session soon. So
that's true. Yeah. You know, that was a very bad situation when they bring that up an hour before it's time to adjourn.
Right, exactly. Okay, so, you know, you talked a little bit about the nationalization of politics in all across the country, but in your district in particular. So President Trump actually won 74% of the vote in your district, and Senator Rand Paul won 60% of the vote. And like several districts outside of the metro areas of the state, Democrats really depend on voters splitting their tickets between Republicans on the federal side and Democrats on the state side in order to win seats. So tell us a little bit how you approach campaigning as a Democrat, you know, in this environment.
Yeah, I think that what I did was a little bit unorthodox. I ran my own race. I did not align myself with anyone, you know, a lot of people. And I may like the people that are Democrats running, but I just try to run my own race. And take, for example, in Estill County, I think I got almost 700 more votes in Estill County than Amy McGrath. Now, that doesn't mean I'm a better candidate than Amy McGrath. What I'm saying is I just tried to. I'm Cluster Howard. These are my positions. I work hard for you. I'm not aligned with any person who's going to be in national politics. You have to decide what you're going to do in terms of supporting that person. I just want you to support me.
Mm-hmm.
That was the philosophy I had. It worked well for me this time. Didn't work so well in 16. You know, I got
right.
Trump.
Mm-hmm.
Even on the local races, I never aligned myself with any person locally. I'm running my own race. That's the only way I can be effective.
Right. Absolutely. Running your own race is one thing, but you probably have a perspective of somebody from, you know, this area that may give you a specific insight into how national Democrats can become a little bit more competitive in places like the 91st District. And, you know, we have a Senate race coming up in 2020, and we have a race for the president coming up then, too. And of course, all the House of Representatives seats in the federal government. And you know, if it were up to you, how would you give advice to Democrats to run in places like the 91st District and be a little bit more competitive?
What we have to do in this particular district is not let the Republicans formulate the narrative, which they've done very well. Of course, they have many more resources. They use social media. They use advertising. And in my opinion, you know, they send out a message that is not necessarily true. And they try to nationalize these races, as you indicated. You know, every time that I run, there's pictures of me with Secretary Clinton, President Obama, or that I'm trying to let immigrants in from South America. And we've not done a good job addressing that and creating a narrative for the Democratic Party. We tend to stay on the defense all the time. And we've got to find a way that we resonate with people and that we have issues people are interested in, and we can, you know, project those issues to the people and not just be on the defensive all the time. Now, you think about over the last four or five election cycles, we are not really giving out a lot of information about what we believe. Now, we did a better job, I think, in the representative the last time on the national level, with health care. And so my advice is we've got to be a little bit less on the defensive, in particular, so I'm trying to nationalize policy.
Well, that's all good advice, I feel like. All right, last but not least, Representative Howard, do you have any thoughts that you could share with us about the Democratic statewide primary coming up this month?
I think you've got three good candidates. They all have strengths in different areas. I do think that there's this opinion out there that Matt Bevin is going to be easy to be defeated in the fall. I disagree with that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that he's going to go in as his favorite. I think whoever's a Democratic nominee has a lot of work to do.
Yeah.
I fully expect President Trump and Vice President Pence to spend a lot of time in Kentucky. I think there's only a few governorships up for grabs. So I think we've got to forget about this idea that whoever the nominee is going to win. Matt Bevin is the favorite right now. We've got three good candidates. I am glad that the candidates are not attacking each other in the primary. I think that's going to help us in the fall.
Mm-hmm. We all agree, I think, that we have three good candidates, or at least everybody that we've spoken to has said that. So it's good to know that basically everybody's on the same page, I think, about the candidates. But yeah.
Right.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us today. We really enjoyed it.
Well, I enjoyed you, and thank you for what you do. I'm a firm believer in the all sorts of media, social media included, and we need to make people more aware of the choices, more aware of the policies, and we need to get more people to vote.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jasmine, how can people get a hold of us?
They can find us on Twitter and Instagram at MyOldKWAPPod. They can like our Facebook page and listen to our podcast on the podcast app of their choice. And we have a newsletter that comes out on Friday mornings, and we partner with Forward Kentucky to do that. So you can subscribe to that at forwardky.com/email, as well as their other newsletters. And finally, we have a Patreon page that you can subscribe to and sponsor us for as little as $1 a month. And we'll send you a sticker. And maybe we'll have some better rewards in the future. But you can do that at patreon.com/myoldkentuckypodcast.
All right, everybody. Thank you very much. And we will see you next week.